This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Jade City, The Greenbone Saga, Book 1. Written by Fonda Lee. Read by Andrew Cascino. Dedication. For my brother. Chapter 1. The Twice Lucky. The two would-be jade thieves sweated in the kitchen of the Twice Lucky restaurant. The windows were open in the dining room, and the onset of evening brought a breeze off the waterfront to cool the diners. But in the kitchen, there were only the two ceiling fans that had been spinning all day to little effect. Summer had barely begun, and already the city of John Loon was like a spent lover, sticky and fragrant. Barrow and Sampa were 16 years old, and after 3 weeks of planning, they had decided that tonight would change their lives. Barrow wore a waiter's dark pants and a white shirt that clung uncomfortably to his back. His sallow face and chapped lips were stiff from holding in his thoughts. He carried a tray of dirty drink glasses over to the kitchen sink and set it down, then wiped his hands on a dish towel and leaned toward his co-conspirator, who was rinsing dishes with the spray hose before stacking them in the drying racks.
"He's alone now," Barrow kept his voice low.
Sampa glanced up. He was an Abuke teenager, copper-skinned with thick, wiry hair and slightly pudgy cheeks that gave him a faintly cherubic appearance. He blinked rapidly, then turned back to the sink.
"I get off my shift in 5 minutes."
"We gotta do it now, KK," said Barrow. "Hand it over."
Sampa dried a hand on the front of his shirt and pulled a small paper envelope from his pocket. He slipped it quickly into Barrow's palm. Barrow tucked his hand under his apron, picked up his empty tray, and walked out of the kitchen. At the bar, he asked the bartender for a rum with chili and lime on the rocks, Sean Judon Rue's preferred drink. Barrow carried the drink away, then put down his tray and bent over an empty table by the wall, his back to the dining room floor. As he pretended to wipe down the table with his towel, he emptied the contents of the paper packet into the glass. They fizzed quickly and dissolved in the amber liquid. He straightened and made his way over to the bar table in the corner. Sean Ju was still sitting by himself, his bulk squeezed onto a small chair. Earlier in the evening, Mate Ken had been at the table as well, but to Barrow's great relief, he'd left to rejoin his brother in a booth on the other side of the room. Barrow set the glass down in front of Sean.
"On the house, Sean Jen."
Sean took the drink, nodding sleepily without looking up. He was a regular at the Twice Lucky and drank heavily. The bald spot in the center of his head was pink under the dining room lights. Barrow's eyes were drawn, irresistibly, farther down to the three green studs in the man's left ear. He walked away before he could be caught staring. It was ridiculous that such a corpulent aging drunk was a greenbone. True, Sean had only a little jade on him, but unimpressive as he was, sooner or later, someone would take it, along with his life, perhaps.
"And why not me?" Barrow thought. Why not indeed?
He might only be a dock worker's bastard who would never have a martial education at Wylon Temple School or Kal Duchiron Academy, but at least he was Kekanese all the way through. He had guts and nerve. He had what it took to be somebody. Jade made you somebody. He passed the Make brothers sitting in a booth with a third young man. Barrow slowed a little, just to get a closer look at them. Make Ken and Make Tar, now they were real greenbones. Sinewy men, their fingers heavy with jade rings, fighting talon knives with jade inlaid hilts strapped to their waists. They were dressed well. Dark collared shirts and tailored tan jackets, shiny black shoes, billed hats. The Makes were well-known members of the No-Peak clan, which controlled most of the neighborhoods on this side of the city. One of them glanced in Barrow's direction. Barrow turned away quickly, busying himself with clearing dishes. The last thing he wanted was for the Make brothers to pay any attention to him tonight. He resisted the urge to reach down to check the small caliber pistol tucked in the pocket of his pants and concealed by his apron. Patience. After tonight, he wouldn't be in this waiter's uniform anymore. He wouldn't have to serve anyone anymore. Back in the kitchen, Sampa had finished his shift for the evening and was signing out. He looked questioningly at Barrow, who nodded that the deed was done. Sampa's small white upper teeth popped into view and crushed down on his lower lip.
"You really think we can do this?" he whispered.
Barrow brought his face near the other boy's.
"Stay cut, KK," he hissed. "We're already doing it. No turning back. You got to do your part."
"I know, KK, I know. I will."
Sampa gave him a hurt and sour look.
"Think of the money," Barrow suggested, and gave him a shove. "Now get going."
Sampa cast a final nervous glance backward, then pushed out the kitchen door. Barrow glared after him, wishing for the 100th time that he didn't need such a doughy and insipid partner. But there was no getting around it. Only a full-blooded Abuké native, immune to jade, could palm a gem and walk out of a crowded restaurant without giving himself away. It had taken some convincing to bring Sampa on board. Like many in his tribe, the boy gambled on the river, spending his weekends diving for jade runoff that escaped the mines far upstream. It was dangerous. When glutted with rainfall, the torrent carried away more than a few unfortunate divers, and even if you were lucky and found jade, Sampa had bragged that he'd once found a piece the size of a fist, you might get caught. Spend time in jail if you were lucky, time in the hospital if you weren't. It was a loser's game, Barrow had insisted to him. Why fish for raw jade just to sell it to the black market middlemen who carved it up and smuggled it off island, paying you only a fraction of what they sold it for later? A couple of clever, daring fellows like them, they could do better. If you were going to gamble for jade, Barrow said, then gamble big. Aftermarket gems, cut and set, those was worth real money. Barrow turned to the dining room and busied himself clearing and setting tables, glancing at the clock every few minutes. He could ditch Sampa later, after he'd gotten what he needed.
"Shanju says there's been trouble in the armpit," said Make Ken, leaning in to speak discreetly under the blanket of background noise. "A bunch of kids shaking down businesses."
His younger brother, Make Tar, reached across the table with his chopsticks to pluck at the plate of crispy squid balls.
"What kind of kids are we talking about?"
"Low-level fingers. Young toughs with no more than a piece or two of jade."
The third man at the table wore an uncharacteristically pensive frown.
"Even the littlest fingers are clan soldiers. They take orders from their fists, and fists from their horn."
The armpit district had always been disputed territory, but directly threatening establishments affiliated with the No-Peak clan was too bold to be the work of careless hoodlums.
"Smells like someone's pissing on us."
The Makes glanced at him, then at each other.
"What's going on, Helogen?" asked Ken. "You seem out of sorts tonight."
"Do I?"
Carl Heloshudon leaned against the wall in the booth and turned his glass of rapidly warming beer, idly wiping off the condensation.
"Maybe it's the heat."
Ken motioned to one of the waiters to refill their drinks. The pallid teenager kept his eyes down as he served them. He glanced up at Hilo for a second, but didn't seem to recognize him. Few people who hadn't met Carl Heloshudon in person expected him to look as young as he did. The horn of the No-Peak clan, second only in authority to his elder brother, often went initially unnoticed in public. Sometimes this galled Hilo. Sometimes he found it useful.
"Another strange thing," said Ken when the waiter had left.
No one's seen or heard from Three-Finger G. How's it possible to lose track of Three-Finger G? Tar wondered.
The black market jade carver was as recognizable for his girth as he was for his deformity.
Maybe he got out of the business.
Tar snickered.
Only one way anyone gets out of the jade business.
A voice spoke up near Hilo's ear.
Kaljed, how are you this evening? Is everything to your satisfaction tonight?
Mr. Une had appeared beside their table and was smiling the anxious, solicitous smile he had always reserved for them.
It's all excellent, as usual, Hilo said, arranging his face into the relaxed, lopsided smile that was more his typical expression.
The owner of the Twice Lucky clasped his kitchen-scarred hands together, nodding and smiling his humble thanks. Mr. Une was a man in his 60s, bald and well-padded, and a third-generation restaurateur. His grandfather had founded the venerable old establishment, and his father had kept it running all through the wartime years and afterward. Like his predecessors, Mr. Une was a loyal lantern man in the No Peak clan. Every time Hilo was in, he came around personally to pay his respects.
"Please let me know if there's anything else I can have brought out to you," he insisted.
When the reassured Mr. Une had departed, Hilo grew serious again.
"Ask around some more. Find out what happened to G." "Why do we care about G?" Ken asked,
not in an impertinent way, just curious.
"Good riddance to him. One less carver sneaking our jade out to weaklings and foreigners. It bothers me, is all."
Hilo sat forward, helping himself to the last crispy squid ball.
"Nothing good's coming when the dogs start disappearing from the streets."
Barrow's nerves were beginning to fray. Shan Ju had nearly drained his tainted drink. The drug was supposedly tasteless and odorless, but what if Shan, with the enhanced senses of a greenbone, could detect it somehow? Or what if it didn't work as it should, and the man walked out, taking his jade out of Barrow's grasp? What if Sampa lost his nerve after all? The spoon in Barrow's hands trembled as he set it down on the table.
"Stay cut now. Be a man."
A phonograph in the corner wheezed out a slow, romantic opera tune, barely audible through the unceasing chatter of people. Cigarette smoke and spicy food aromas hung languid over red tablecloths. Shan Ju swayed hastily to his feet. He staggered toward the back of the restaurant and pushed through the door to the men's room. Barrow counted 10 slow seconds in his head, then put the tray down and followed casually. As he slipped into the restroom, he slid his hand into his pocket and closed it around the grip of the tiny pistol. He shut and locked the door behind him and pressed against the far wall. The sound of sustained retching issued from one of the stalls, and Barrow nearly gagged on the nauseating odor of booze-soaked vomit. The toilet flushed, and the heaving noises ceased. There was a muffled thud, like the sound of something heavy hitting the tile floor, then a sickly silence. Barrow took several steps forward. His heartbeat thundered in his ears. He raised the small gun to chest level. The stall door was open. Shan Ju's large bulk was slumped inside, limbs sprawled. His chest rose and fell in soft, snuffling snores. A thin line of drool ran from the corner of his mouth. A pair of grimy canvas shoes moved in the far stall, and Sampa stuck his head around the corner where he'd been lying in wait. His eyes grew round at the sight of the pistol, but he sidled over next to Barrow, and the two of them stared down at the unconscious man.
"Holy shit, it worked. What are you waiting for?"
Barrow waved the small gun in Sean's direction.
"Go on, get it."
Sampa squeezed hesitantly through the half-open stall door. Shan Ju's head was leaning to the left, his jade-studded ear trapped against the wall of the toilet cubicle. With the screwed-up face of someone about to touch a live power line, the boy placed his hands on either side of Sean's head. He paused. The man didn't stir. Sampa turned the slack-jowled face to the other side. With shaking fingers, he pinched the first jade earring and worked the backing free.
Here, use this.
Barrow handed him the empty paper packet. Sampa dropped the jade stud into it and got to work removing the second earring. Barrow's eyes danced between the jade, Shanju, the gun, Sampa, again the jade. He took a step forward and held the barrel of the pistol a few inches from the prone man's temple. It looked distressingly compact and ineffective, a commoner's weapon. No matter. Shanju wasn't going to be able to steal or deflect anything in his state. Sampa would palm the jade and walk out the back door with no one the wiser. Barrow would finish his shift and meet up with Sampa afterward. No one would disturb old Shanju for hours. It wasn't the first time the man had passed out drunk in a restroom.
"Hurry it up," Barrow said.
Sampa had two of the jade stones off and was working on the third. His fingers dug around in the fold of the man's fleshy ear.
"I can't get this one off. Pull it off. Just pull it off."
Sampa gave the last stubborn earring a swift yank. It tore free from the flesh that had grown around it. Shanju jerked. His eyes flew open.
"Oh, shit," said Sampa.
With an almighty howl, Sean's arms shot out, flailing around his head and knocking Barrow's arm upward just as Barrow pulled the trigger of the gun. The shot deafened all of them but went wide, punching into the plaster ceiling. Sampa scrambled to get away, nearly tripping over Sean as he lunged for the stall door. Sean flung his arms around one of the boy's legs. His bloodshot eyes rolled in disorientation and rage. Sampa tumbled to the ground and put his hands out to break his fall. The paper packet jumped from his grasp and skittered across the tile floor between Barrow's legs.
"Thieves!"
Shanju's snarling mouth formed the word, but Barrow did not hear it. His head was ringing from the gunshot, and everything was happening as if in a soundless chamber. He stared as the red-faced greenbone dragged at the terrified Abuke boy like a grasping demon from a pit. Barrow bent, snatched the crumpled paper envelope, and ran for the door. He forgot he'd locked it. For a second, he pushed and pulled in stupid panic before turning the bolt and pounding out of the room. The diners had heard the gunshot, and dozens of shocked faces were turned toward him. Barrow had just enough presence of mind left to jam the gun into his pocket and point a finger back toward the restroom.
"There's a jade thief in there," he shouted.
Then he ran across the dining room floor, weaving between tables, the two small stones digging through the paper and against the palm of his tightly fisted left hand. People leapt away from him, faces blurred past. Barrow knocked over a chair, fell, picked himself up again, and kept running. His face was burning. A sudden surge of heat and energy, unlike anything he had ever felt before, ripped through him like an electric current. He reached the wide, curving staircase that led to the second floor, where diners were getting up and peering over the balcony railing to see what the commotion was. Barrow rushed up the stairs, clearing the entire expanse in a few bounds, his feet barely touching the floor. A gasp ran through the crowd. Barrow's surprise burst into ecstasy. He threw his head back to laugh. This must be lightness. A film had been lifted from his eyes and ears. The scrape of chair legs, the crash of a plate, the taste of the air on his tongue. Everything was razor sharp. Someone reached out to grab him, but he was so slow, and Barrow was so fast. He swerved with ease and leapt off the surface of a table, scattering dishes and eliciting screams. There was a sliding screen door ahead of him that led out onto the patio overlooking the harbor. Without thinking, without pausing, he crashed through the barrier like a charging bull. The wooden latticework shattered, and Barrow stumbled through the body-sized hole he had made with a mad shout of exultation. He felt no pain at all, only a wild, fierce invincibility. This was the power of jade. The night air blasted him, tingling against his skin. Below, the expanse of gleaming water beckoned irresistibly. Waves of delicious heat seemed to be coursing through Barrow's veins. The ocean looked so cool, so refreshing. It would feel so good. He flew toward the patio railing. Hands clamped onto his shoulders and pulled him to a hard stop. Barrow was yanked back as if he'd reached the end of a chain and spun around to face Maktar. Chapter 2. The Horn of No Peak. The muffled gunshot went off on the other side of the dining room. A second or two later, Hilo felt it, the sudden shriek in his mind of an uncontrolled jade aura, as grating as a fork being dragged across glass. Ken and Tar turned in their seats as the teenage waiter burst from the restroom and ran for the stairs. "Tar," said Hilo, but there was no need. Both the makes were already moving. Ken went into the restroom. Tar leapt to the top of the stairs, caught the thief on the patio, and threw him bodily back through the broken screen door. A collective gasp and a number of screams broke out from the diners as the boy came flying back inside, hit the ground, and skidded to the top of the staircase. Tar stepped into the building after him, stooping to clear the wreckage of the entryway. Before the boy could scramble to his feet, Tar palmed his head and forced it to the floor. The thief reached for a weapon, a small gun, but Tar tore it from him and flung it through the broken patio door and into the harbor. The boy gave a carpet-muffled cry as the greenbone's knee ground down on his forearm and the paper packet was ripped from his white-knuckled grip. All this occurred so fast, most of the onlookers did not see it. Tar stood up, the teenager at his feet spasming and moaning as the jangling jade energy crashed out of his body, taking with it the angry buzz in Hilo's skull. The younger make hauled the thief to his feet by the back of his waiter's shirt and dragged him back down the staircase to the main floor. The excited diners who'd left their tables backed silently out of his way. Ken came out of the restroom, hauling a quietly whimpering Abuke boy along by the arm. He pushed the boy to his knees, and Tar deposited the thief next to him. Sean Judonru wobbled forward after Ken, steadying himself on the backs of the chairs he passed. He didn't look entirely sure of where he was or how he had gotten there, but he was lucid enough to be enraged. His unfocused eyes bugged out from his skull. One hand was clapped to his ear. "Thieves," he slurred. Sean reached for the hilt of the Talon knife sheathed in a shoulder holster under his jacket. "I'm gonna gut them both." Mr. Une ran up, waving his arms in protest.
"Shanzhen, I beg you, please, not in the dining room."
He held his shaking hands out in front of him, his jowly face white with disbelief. It was terrible enough that the twice lucky had been shamed, that the restaurant's kitchen had harbored jade thieves, but for the two boys to be publicly slain right next to the buffet dessert table, no business could survive the stain of such bad luck. The restaurant owner cast a fearful glance at Shanju's weapon, then at the Make brothers and the surrounding stares of frozen customers. His mouth worked.
"This is a terrible outrage, but, gentlemen, please."
"Mr. Une!" Hilo got up from his table. "I didn't realize you'd added live entertainment."
All eyes turned as Hilo crossed the room. He felt a stir of understanding go through the crowd. The nearest diners noticed what Barrow, in his initial cursory glance, had not. Underneath Call Hilo's smoke-colored sport jacket, and the unfastened top two buttons of his baby blue shirt. A long line of small jade stones was embedded in the skin of his collarbone, like a necklace fused into his flesh. Mr. Une rushed over and walked alongside Hilo, wringing his hands.
"Call Jen. I couldn't be more embarrassed that your evening was disturbed. I don't know how these two worthless little thieving shits wormed their way into my kitchen. Is there anything I could do to make it up to you?
Anything at all. As much food and drink as you could want, of course."
"These things happen."
Hilo offered up a disarming smile, but the restaurateur did not relax. If anything, he looked even more nervous as he nodded and wiped at his damp brow. Hilo said,
"Put away your towel and knife, Uncle Jew. Mr. Rune has enough to clean up already without blood in the carpet. And I'm sure all these people who are paying for a nice dinner don't want their appetites ruined."
Shanju hesitated. Hilo had called him uncle, shown him respect despite his obvious public humiliation. That was not, apparently, enough to mollify him. He jabbed the blade in Barrow and Sampa's direction.
"They're jade thieves. I'm entitled to their lives, and no one can tell me otherwise."
Hilo held out his hand to Tar, who passed him the paper packet. He shook the two stones out into his palm. Ken held out the third earring. Hilo rolled the three green studs in his hand thoughtfully, and looked at Sean with eyes narrowed in reproach. The anger went out of Shanju's face, replaced with trepidation. He stared at his jade, cupped in another man's hand, its power now running through Call Hilo instead of him. Sean went still. No one else spoke. The silence was suddenly charged. Sean cleared his throat roughly.
"Call Jen. I didn't mean my words to suggest any disrespect to your position as Horn."
This time, he spoke with the deference he would have shown to an older man.
"Of course, I'm obedient to the clan's judgment in all matters of justice."
Smiling, Hilo took Sean's hand and dropped the three gemstones into his palm. He closed the man's fingers around them gently.
"Then no serious harm's been done. I like it when Ken and Tar have a reason to stay on their toes."
He winked at the two brothers as if sharing a schoolyard joke. But when he turned back to Shanju, his face was devoid of humor.
"Perhaps, Uncle," he said, "it's time to be drinking a little less and watching your jade a little more."
Shanju clutched the returned gemstones, bringing his fist close to his chest in a spasm of relief. His thick neck flushed red with indignity, but he said nothing further. Even in his bleary, half-drugged state, the man wasn't stupid. He understood he'd been given a warning, and after his pitiful lapse tonight, he remained a greenbone only on account of Call Hilo's say-so. He backed away in a cowed stoop. Hilo turned and waved his arms to the transfixed crowd.
"Show's over, everyone. No charge for the entertainment tonight. Let's order some more of Mr. Une's delicious food and another round of drinks."
A nervous ripple of laughter traveled through the dining room as people obeyed, turning back to their meals and companions, though they kept stealing glances at Call Hilo, the Makes, and the two sorry teens on the floor. It wasn't especially often that ordinary, jadeless citizens were witness to such a dramatic display of greenbone abilities. They would go home and tell their friends about what they'd seen, how the thief had moved faster than any normal human being and plowed through a wooden door, how much faster and stronger still the Make brothers were in comparison, and how even they deferred to the young Horn. Ken and Tar lifted the thieves and carried them out of the building. Hilo began to follow, Mr. Une still scurrying along beside him, stammering quietly,
"Once again, I beg your forgiveness. I screen all my waitstaff carefully. I had no idea."
Hilo put a hand on the man's shoulder.
"It's not your fault. You can't always tell which ones will catch jade fever and go bad. We'll take care of it outside.
Mr. Une nodded in vigorous relief. He wore the expression of someone who'd nearly been hit by a bus, only to have it swerve out of the way and drop a suitcase of money at his feet. If Hilo and the Makes had not been present tonight, he would have had two dead boys and one very angry, drunken greenbone on his hands. With the Horn's public endorsement, however, the twice lucky had escaped being disastrously tainted, and instead gained respect. Word of tonight's events would spread, and the publicity would keep the restaurant busy for some time. The thought made Hilo feel better. The Twice Lucky wasn't the only no-peak business in the neighborhood, but it was one of the largest and most profitable. The clan needed its tribute money. Even more importantly, no-peak couldn't afford the loss of face if the place failed or was taken over. If a loyal lantern man like Mr. Une lost his livelihood or his life, the responsibility would fall on Hilo. He trusted Mr. Une, but people were people. They sided with the powerful. The Twice Lucky might be a no-peak establishment today, but if the worst came to pass, and the owner was forced to switch allegiance in exchange for keeping his family business and his head on his shoulders, Hilo held little illusion as to what choice he would make. Lantern men were jadeless civilians, after all. They were part of the clan and crucial to its workings. But they would not die for it. They were not greenbones. Hilo paused and pointed up at the destroyed screen door.
Send me the bill for the damage. I'll take care of it.
Mr. Une blinked, then clasped his hands together and touched them to his forehead several times in respectful gratitude.
You are too generous, Kaljen. That's not necessary.
Don't be silly, said Hilo.
He faced the man.
Tell me, my friend, have you had any other trouble around here lately?
The restaurant owner's eyes jumped around before landing nervously back on Hilo's face.
What sort of trouble, Kaljen?
Greenbones from other clans, Hilo said. That sort of trouble.
Mr. Une hesitated, then drew Hilo aside and lowered his voice.
Not here in the docks, not yet. But a friend of my nephew, he works as a bartender at the Dancing Girl over in the Armpit District. He says he's seen men from the Mountain Clan coming in almost every night, sitting down where they please and expecting their drinks to be free. They're saying it's part of their tribute, and that the Armpit is mountain territory.
Mr. Une took a sudden step back, unnerved by the expression on Hilo's face.
It might be nothing more than talk, but since you asked...
Hilo patted the man's arm.
Talk is never just talk. Let us know if you hear anything else, won't you?
You call if you ever need to.
Of course I will, Kaljen, said Mr. Une, touching his hands to his forehead once more.
Hilo gave the man a final firm pat on the shoulder and left the restaurant. Outside, Hilo paused to pull a packet of cigarettes from his pocket. They were expensive Aspenian cigarettes. He had a weakness for them. He put one in his mouth and looked around.
About over there, he suggested.
The Make brothers hauled the teenagers away from the Twice Lucky and pushed them down the gravel slope to the edge of the water, out of sight of the road. The pudgy Abuke boy cried and struggled the whole way. The other one was limp and silent. The Makes threw the thieves to the ground and began to beat them. Heavy, rhythmic blows to the torso, pounding the ribs, stomach, and back. Smacks to the face until the boy's features were swollen almost beyond recognition. No strikes to the vital organs, the throat, or the back of the skull. Ken and Tar were good fists. They were not careless and would not be carried away by bloodlust. Hilo smoked a cigarette and watched. Night had fallen completely now, but it was not dark. Streetlights blazed all along the waterfront, and the headlights of cars driving by bathed the road in pulses of white. Far out on the water, The slowly traveling lights of shipping vessels were smeared into blotches by sea fog and the haze of pollution from the city. The air was warm and heavy with fumes, the sweetness of overripe fruit, and the stink of 900,000 perspiring inhabitants. Hilo was 27 years old, but even he remembered a time when cars and televisions were a new thing in Jonlun. Now they were everywhere, along with more people, new factories, foreign-influenced street foods like tempura meatballs and spicy cheese curd. The metropolis strained at its seams, and it felt as if all the people, Greenbones as well, strained with it. There was an undercurrent, Hilo thought, of everything running a bit too dangerously fast all the time, as if the city were an oily new machine cranked to its highest setting, teetering just on the edge of out of control, disrupting the natural order of things. What was the world coming to that a couple of clumsy, untrained dock brats could figure on stealing jade off a Greenbone and nearly succeed? In truth, it would serve Sean Judonru right to lose his jade. Hilo could have claimed the three studs for himself as justifiable punishment for Sean's ineptitude. He'd been tempted, certainly, by the energy that had radiated like liquid warmth through his veins when he'd rolled the stones in his hand. But there was no respect for taking a few gems from a sorry old man. That was what these jade thieves didn't understand. Jade alone didn't make you a Greenbone. Blood and training and clan made you a jade warrior. That's how it had always been. Hilo had both personal and clan reputation to uphold at all times. Sean Judonru was a drunkard, an old fool, a comical has-been of a Greenbone. But he was still a finger in the employ of No Peak, and that made an offense against him, Hilo's concern. He dropped his cigarette and ground it out. "That's good," he said. Ken stepped back at once. Tar, always the more industrious of the two, gave each boy a final kick before following suit. Hilo studied the teenagers more closely. The one in the waiter's shirt had the classic Kekanese Islander look. The leanness, the long arms, the dark hair, and dark eyes. He lay half dead, though it was hard to say if the jade fallout or the beating had done more to make him that way. The round-faced Abuke boy sobbed quietly through a constant stream of pleading.
"It wasn't my idea. It wasn't. I didn't want to. Please let me go. Please. I promise I won't. I won't."
Hilo considered the possibility that the boys were not the imbeciles they seemed, but spies or hired criminals working for the Mountain or perhaps one of the smaller clans. He decided the odds of it were low. He squatted down and pushed the hair off the Abuke boy's wet brow, causing him to flinch back in terror. Hilo shook his head and sighed. "What were you thinking?"
"He promised me we could make a lot of money,"
the teen wept, sounding more than a little wronged.
"He said the old man was so drunk he wouldn't even notice. He said he knew a buyer, a reliable one, someone who would pay the highest rates for cut jade without asking questions."
"And you believed him? No one crazy enough to steal jade off a Greenbone means to sell it."
Hilo stood up. There was nothing to be done for the Kekanese boy. Angry young men were prone to jade fever. Hilo had seen it plenty of times. Poor and naive, full of feral energy and ambition, they were drawn to jade like ants to honey. They romanticized the legendary hero bandit Greenbones that filled comic books and movies with their exploits. They noticed how people said Jen with respect and a little fear, and they wanted that for themselves. Never mind that without the years of strict martial training, they weren't capable of controlling the powers jade conferred. They flamed out, went mad, destroyed themselves and others. No. That one was a hopeless case. The Abuke boy, though, was merely stupid. Fatally so? You could forgive someone like him for playing the lottery by river diving. You couldn't forgive a gross offense against the clan. As if sensing Hilo's thoughts, the teenager sped up his verbal torrent.
Please, call Jen. It was stupid. I know it was stupid. I'll never do it again. I swear. I've only ever taken jade from the river. If it wasn't for the new carver taking out G, I wouldn't have even thought about doing anything else. I've learned my lesson. I swear on my grandmother's grave I won't touch jade again. I promise.
What did you just say? Hilo crouched back down and leaned in, eyes squinted. The teenager raised his eyes in fearful confusion. About a new carver, Hilo said. Under Hilo's insistent gaze, the boy quailed.
I used to sell whatever I found in the river to Three-Fingered G. For raw jade, he paid on the spot in cash. Not a lot, but still pretty good. G was the carver on this side of town that most of us...
I know who he is, said Hilo impatiently. What happened to him? Slow, shrewd hope crawled into the boy's eyes with the realization that he had information the Horn of the No-Peak Clan did not.
G's gone. The new carver showed up last month, said he would buy as much jade as we could bring him, raw or cut, no questions asked. He offered to join up with Three-Fingered G, but G didn't see the point of splitting his business with a newcomer, so the new guy killed him.
The boy wiped snot and blood from his nose onto his sleeve.
They say he strangled G with a telephone cord, then cut off the rest of his fingers and sent them to the other carvers in the city as a warning. Now anything we find in the river goes to him, and he only pays half of what G used to pay. That's why I tried to get out of diving.
Have you seen this man? Hilo asked. The teenager hesitated, trying to decide which answer would save him. And which would get him killed.
Yes, just once.
Hilo exchanged a glance with his fists. The Abuke boy had solved one vexing mystery for them, but raised another. Three-Fingered G might be a black market jade carver, but he was a familiar one, a known entity, the stray dog in Hilo's yard that stole from garbage cans, but was not troublesome enough to be worth killing. So long as he confined himself to buying raw jade from the Abuke, the clans left his little smuggling business alone in exchange for occasional tip-offs on bigger fish. Who would flout No-Peak authority by killing him? He turned back to the boy. Could you describe him, this new carver? Again, the hesitation.
Yes, I think so.
When the boy had stuttered through a description, Hilo stood up.
Bring the car around, he said to Ken. We're taking these boys to see the pillar.
Chapter 3 The Sleepless Pillar. Kal Lan Xinhuan could not sleep. He had once been a reliable sleeper, but at least once a week for the past 3 months, he'd found himself unable to drift off. His bedroom, which faced east from the upper floor of the main house on the Kal property, felt obscenely large and empty, as did his bed. On some nights, he stared out the windows until the glow of dawn crawled its tepid way across the view of the city's skyline. He tried meditating to calm himself before bed. He drank herbal tea and soaked in a salt bath. He supposed he ought to consult a doctor. Perhaps a greenbone physician could determine what energy imbalance he had, unclog whatever flow was blocked, prescribe the right foods to restore equilibrium. He resisted. At the age of 35, he was supposed to be in the prime of his health and at the peak of his power. It was why his grandfather had finally consented to cede leadership to him. Why the rest of No-Peak accepted that the mantle had passed from the legendary but old and ailing Kal Sennington to his grandson. If word got out that the pillar of the clan was suffering health problems, it would not reflect well on him. Even something as mundane as insomnia might arouse speculation. Was he mentally unstable? Unable to carry his jade? Being perceived as weak could be fatal. Lan got up, put on a shirt, and went downstairs. He slipped on his shoes and went into the garden. Being outside made him feel better at once. The family estate sat near the heart of John Loon. One could see the red roof of the Royal Council building and the tiered conical top of the Triumphal Palace from the upstairs windows of the house. But the buildings and landscaped grounds of the Call property sprawled across 5 acres and were enclosed by high brick walls that sheltered it from the surrounding urban bustle. To a greenbone, it was not quiet. Lon could hear the rustle of a mouse in the grass, the whir of a small insect over the pond, the crunch of his own shoes along the smooth pebbled path, but the ever-present hum of the city was faint. The garden was an oasis of peace. Alone in this small patch of nature, away from the heady swirl of other jade auras, he could relax. He sat down on a stone bench and closed his eyes. Settling into his own heartbeat and breath, into the steady churn of blood through his veins, he explored unhurriedly. He followed the wing beats of a bat overhead as it darted this way, then that, snatching insects out of the air. From the breeze skimming across the small pond, he picked out the scent of blooms. Orange, magnolia, honeysuckle. He searched along the ground for the mouse he'd sensed earlier and found it, a hot spot of thrumming life, stark and bright in the darkness of the lawn. When he'd been a student at Call Dushuron Academy, he'd spent a night locked in a cavernous, pitch-black underground chamber with 3 rats. It was one of the tests of perception administered to initiates at the age of 14. He'd groped blindly along the cold stone walls, listening for the inaudible scritch of tiny claws, questing for blood heat like a snake, keenly aware that the exam ended if, and only if, he caught and killed all 3 of the sharp-toothed rats with his bare hands. Lon's back tensed at the memory. A sharp nudge in the periphery of his awareness. Doru was approaching, crossing the garden, the invisible but distinctive jade aura that surrounded him parting the night like thin red light cutting through smoke. Lon let out his breath and opened his eyes, a grimace of a smile tilting his mouth. If Doru found him catching mice in the garden at night, it would be a far greater symptom of instability than mere insomnia. He was irritated, though, at having his solitude interrupted, and did not get up to greet the man. Yundurupan's voice was soft and raspy. It smelled medicinal and sounded like gravel being sloshed in a pan.
"Sitting out here alone? Something the matter, Lansa?"
Lon frowned at the man's use of the familial endearment. It was a suffix to be used with children and the elderly, not one superior. For a weatherman to use the term with his pillar suggested a subtle insubordination. Lon knew that Doru meant no disrespect. Old habits were simply hard to break. Doru had known him since he was a boy, had been a fixture in the clan, and in the Call household for as long as Lon could remember. Now, however, the man was supposed to be his strategist and trusted advisor, not his minder and uncle figure.
"Nothing," Lon said, finally standing up and turning to face the man. "I like it out here in the garden at night. It's important to be alone with your thoughts sometimes."
A mild rebuke for the intrusion. Doru did not seem to notice.
"I'm sure you have a lot on your mind."
The weatherman was a rail-thin figure with an egg-shaped head and tapered chin, who wore wool sweaters and dark blazers that padded him up even in the oppressive heat of summer. His stiff manner gave him the air of an academic, but that was grossly misleading. Decades ago, Doru had been a mountain man, one of the indomitable rebels led by Call Sennington and Ait Yugontin, who resisted and ultimately ended foreign occupation of the island of Kaikon. Doru had spent the final year of the Many Nations War in a Shatarian prison, and rumor had it that underneath his dowdy clothes he was missing plugs of flesh from his legs and arms, along with both his testicles.
Doru said, "The KJA is due to decide on the latest round of proposed exports by the end of the month. Have you considered whether you'll be lending your approval in the final vote?"
The debate within the Kaikon Jade Alliance over whether to increase the national sale of jade to foreign powers, namely Aspenia and her allies, had been going on all spring.
"You know what I think," Lan said.
"Have you spoken about it to Kaljen?"
Doru meant Carl Sennington, of course.
No matter the three younger greenbones in the family, for Doru, there was only one Carl Jen.
Lan hid his annoyance.
"There's no need to bother him when it's not necessary."
Perhaps Doru wasn't the only member of No Peak who expected Lan to consult his grandfather on all major decisions, but that could not go on. It was past time to start sending the message that he was the one who held sole responsibility as pillar.
"The Aspenians ask too much. If we give in to them every time they want something of us, it won't be long before every last pebble of jade on the island finds itself into an Aspenian military vault."
The weatherman was silent for a moment, then inclined his head.
"As you say."
The thought came to Lan unbidden.
Doru's getting old, too old to change. He was grandfather's weatherman and will always think of himself that way. I'll have to replace him soon.
He cut off his unkind train of thought. A good sense of perception didn't enable a greenbone to read minds, but those with a honed ability could pick up on the subtle physical changes that laid bare emotion and intent. The only visible green on Doru were the understated rings on his thumbs, but Lan knew the man wore most of his jade out of sight and was more skilled than he appeared. He might perceive the sudden turn in Lan's mind, even if there was no sign of it on his face. He masked any possible slip as impatience.
"You didn't come out here just to badger me about KJA business. What else is it?"
The floodlights at the gate switched on, bathing the front of the house and the long driveway with yellow light.
Doru said, "Hilo just arrived. He's asking to see you right away."
Lan crossed the garden and walked quickly toward the shape of Hilo's unmistakable, oversized white sedan. One of his brother's lieutenants, Mate Ken, was leaning against the driver's side door of the Duchesse Prisa, checking his watch. Mate Tars stood off to the side with Hilo. At their feet were two lumps. As Lan drew near, he saw the lumps were a pair of teenage boys, slumped forward over their knees, foreheads to the asphalt.
"Glad I caught you before you went to sleep," Hilo teased. The younger Carl often prowled the streets until dawn. He claimed it was all part of being a good horn, the threat of his nocturnal presence tempering the agents of vice that plied their trade in clan territory when darkness fell. No one could say Carl Hilo was not dedicated to his job, particularly when it involved food and drink, pretty girls and loud music, bars and gambling dens, the occasional incident of explosive violence. Lan ignored the jibe. He looked down at the two boys. They had been badly beaten before being driven here in the car and deposited on the pavement.
"What is this about?"
"That old booze hound Shanju nearly lost his measly bit of jade to these clowns," Hilo said. "But it turns out this one," he nudged the heavier set boy with his foot, "has some interesting news I thought you ought to hear in person. Go on, kid, tell the pillar what you know."
The teenager lifted his face. Both of his eyes were black, and his lip was split. His blood-plugged nose made his voice nasal as he told Lan about the sudden takeover of Three-Finger G's raw jade business.
"I don't know the new guy's name. We just call him the Carver."
"He's Abuke?" Lan asked.
"No,"
slurred the boy through puffy lips.
"A foreign stone eye. He wears an Iguton-style coat and one of those square hats.
He glanced over nervously as his companion stirred and moaned.
"Tell him what the Carver looks like," Hilo demanded.
"I only saw him for a few minutes this one time,"
the boy hedged, frightened anew by Hilo's sharp tone.
"He's short, a little heavy. He has a mustache and spots on his face. He dresses like an Egotanian and carries a gun, but he speaks Kekanese with no accent."
"What territory does he work?"
The Abukaitin was sweating under the interrogation. He lifted his bruised eyes to Lon, begging.
I'm not sure. Most of the forge. Parts of Pawpaw and the docks. Maybe up into Coinwash and Fishtown."
He dropped his forehead to the ground, and his voice became muffled.
"Kul'jin, Pillar, I'm nothing to you. Nothing at all. Just a stupid kid who made a stupid mistake. I've told you everything I know."
The other boy was conscious now, though he remained silent except for his labored breathing. Lon said,
"Look at me."
The teenager raised his head. The whites of his eyes were red from burst capillaries. His expression was sunken and haunted. Not the face of a boy at all, not anymore, but the face of someone who'd tasted jade the wrong way and was ruined because of it. He must be in terrible pain, but he still radiated an inner rage that burned like a gaslight. Lon felt a small knot of pity for him. The boy was a victim of confusing times. The laws of nature used to be clear. The Abuke were immune to jade. Most foreigners were too sensitive to it. Even if a Shatarian or an Aspenian learned to control the physical and mental powers, he would almost certainly fall victim to the itches. Only the Kekanese, an isolated race descended over centuries from the hybridized bloodline of the Abuke and the ancient Tuni settlers to the island, possessed a natural ability to harness jade. And even then, only after years of extensive preparation. Unfortunately, these days exaggerated stories of supposedly self-taught foreigners wearing jade gave impoverished Kekanese kids the wrong idea. It made them think that all they needed were some street fighting lessons and maybe the right chemical aids. Lon said, "Jade is death for people like you. You steal it, you smuggle it, you wear it. It all ends the same way, with you feeding the worms." He fixed the boy with a deadly stern gaze. "Get off my property, both of you, and don't let my brother see you again." The Abuke boy clambered to his feet. Even the other one got up faster than Lon would have thought him capable of. Together they limped hurriedly toward the escape without looking back. Lon said to Mate Ken, "Tell the guard to open the gate." Ken glanced at Hilo for his approval before doing as Lon ordered. The tiny gesture annoyed Lon. The two makes were slavishly loyal to Hilo. They eyed the two fleeing boys carefully, remembering their faces. Hilo's smile was gone. Without it, he looked his real age, instead of barely older than the teenagers he'd brutalized.
"I would have let the Abuke boy live," he said. "But the other one, he made the wrong call. He'll be back. He has that look. I'll only have to kill him later."
Hilo might be right. There were two types of jade thieves. Most wanted what they believed jade could give them. Status, profit, power over others. But for some, the desire for jade itself was a rot in the brain, an obsession that would only grow. Hilo might be comfortable judging and executing for a first offense, but Lon was not ready to say that there was no hope for the boy to find some other outlet for his ill-conceived ambition. "You taught them their lesson," he said. "You have to give people a chance to learn. They're just kids, after all. Stupid kids."
"I don't remember stupidity being an excuse around here when I was a kid."
Lon regarded his brother. Hilo's hands were stuffed into his pockets, his elbows jutted out, and his shoulders curled slightly forward with casual insolence. "You're still a kid," Lon thought ungenerously. The Horn was second in the clan, and of equal rank to the Weatherman. He was supposed to be a seasoned warrior. Hilo was the youngest Horn anyone could remember, but despite this, no one seemed to question his position. Either because he was a call and carried his jade well, or perhaps because, when the old Horn had retired a year and a half ago, Grandfather had approved Hilo's appointment with no